Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
You know, making movies is hard. Welcome. This is a podcast about the struggle of being an independent filmmaker. I'm Mark Purcell, the founding host of the podcast, and my sci-fi horror filmmaker. And my first feature film, The Alternate, is out now on digital DVD and Tubi and also Amazon Prime.
Amazing. I'm Liz Manischel. I'm a writer, director, producer who has directed two features, Bread and Butter and Speed of Life. And I'm currently in pre-production of my third, Best Friends Forever. I'm a producer's rep, and I used to manage Sundance's Creative Distribution Initiative. On this Thursday bonus episode, we're going to play the interview from episode 354 from January 2022 with director Louis Prieto. Louis talks to us about how he got into directing features, directing comedies in Italy before making his first English-speaking film with Shattered. We thought Louis was a good match for Gabriel because they both made movies in other countries and that their previous films were in other languages besides English. After that, we play another round of The Game. But first, make sure you check out our Patreon page. It's part of what keeps this show going. It's patreon.com/mmihpodcast. Make sure to give us a rating or a review on Apple Podcasts. All these things really, really help keep the show going. We're so grateful to you for when you do them. Thank you so much. And without any further bibble babble, here's our throwback interview with Louis Prieto.
Well, Louis Prieto, welcome to the show. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you. My pleasure.
So give us the elevator pitch for Shattered.
Wow. Okay. You killed me then. All right. Shattered is a thriller starring John Malkovich, Frank Grillo, Cameron Monaghan, Lily Crook, and Sasha Juice. It is in the vein of Basic Instinct and Fatal Attraction. It is from the stars like a beautiful love story of two souls that find each other, and everything's going to be really happy after. And then it suddenly has a big dark twist, and everything goes to hell. The protagonist, and by extension, the spectator, find themselves in a big, crazy roller coaster full of violence, cruelty, and also funky, quirky moments.
Amazing. How many days did you shoot the film?
Well, I shot the film in 20 days.
20 days. Wow.
Yes.
If you can say, I mean, 20 days with that kind of cast, that kind of the mental look. I just watched the trailer. I just saw how many locations there are. I mean, that's a lot to do in such a short amount of time. If you can say, what was the rough budget of the movie?
God, I think we're under 5 million. That's probably the number.
And then how did you, well, I know that you weren't the writer, but like, I guess, you know, how did the idea come about? Like, how did you get attached to this project?
Well, let's say the production felt in my hands, you know, through my agents. I read it. I felt it was a page turner. Once I started reading it, I couldn't stop. And as I was reading it, also I was imagining the film. So I said, I want to do this. And then like Hollywood, you say that one day, and then nothing happens for a few years. And then all of a sudden you get a phone call and someone says, hey, you know, remember that the script that you love? It has been greenlit. So that's what happened when the producers called me and said, well, we're ready to make the film. You want to make it? And I said, of course, I want to make it. That was it. You know, then everything fell really fast into place. And we shot the film in the spring of this year. So it was a film that was done under COVID. So it was kind of like every other film that was made, challenging. But also that's what we did.
You mentioned a little bit about the timeline, but like, how long did you spend working on the film from like, you know, like the moment where you read the script and you're like, I love it, to when it's been released?
Well, I would say something, you know, an important thing that every director works preparing a film, and it's everything that happens in your life before that film. Like that already you have been preparing yourself for that moment, you know, for them making the film. Then when they say, okay, you get the film, you know, let's screen, you know, it's greenlit, let's go. You have what is called pre-production. And in this case, I want to think that maybe we have a month and a half of pre-production. I think it was going to be probably a little bit less, but because of COVID, you know, everything was more complicated and everything took more time than one usually would have done, you know, for this kind of film, for this kind of budget. And that was it, you know, maybe a couple more weeks on my own, you know, with DP looking for locations, you know, with very, very reduced crew. But yes, this is kind of like, how can I say? It's like, a tour de force.
And then compared to all the other films that you've made, how difficult was this one?
Well, for good or for bad, the last three films that I have done, they have been films that they look great, all of them, and I think Charlie looks fantastic, but they were also done in very few days. So previous to this one, I did a film with Halle Berry titled Kidnap, and that film was shot in 20 days.
Oh, my God.
So that was crazy. We did have also like two more weeks of second unit photography because it was an action, you know, like a car chase. So basically there was a lot of driving and accidents and things like that. So that took two more weeks. But basically with Halle Berry, that is in every second of the film, she was there for 20 days, just like here. Previous to that, I did another film in England called Pusher. And that one was 25 days. So I want to say, compared to my last three films, it was average. Previous to that, I used to work on, I did romantic comedies. And I have to say that was interesting enough, even though romantic comedies are much easier to shoot than thrillers. It was also maybe different times, you know, I had, or maybe because they were shot in Europe, so budgets were different or who knows what. Those, they were actually 40 days. So, but yeah, sort of got to specialize in making them. I hope it's not my signature, but yes, sometimes you have to shoot it with what you got.
So I wanted to kind of jump back in time a little bit and hear about your start as a filmmaker. So I noticed that your first film was made in Spain, and then you went and you immediately made these movies in Italy, like you were saying, that were like these comedies, romantic comedies. So can you just talk about like how that all came to be, like how you ended up making a movie? Well, it makes sense you made a movie where you're from, but then like how did you end up in Italy making film?
Yeah, well, I have to say, I mean, sometimes life surprises you, and that's what happened to me. My first film was a Spanish production that we ended up shooting in Argentina. So actually I left. So it was a Spanish production, but we shot it in Argentina. And what's happening is one of the producers who was involved during the pre-production, it was this Italian production company. So that idea, they didn't produce the film, but they knew about the whole development process. So once the film was done in Argentina, I came back, I put my film together, and it happened to be that I went to Italy for a week. So just by coincidence, I saw the producers, they asked me, how was the film? I showed it to them, even if it was only film music, the film wasn't finished yet. And they loved it and they said, listen, we want to shoot a romantic comedy where the protagonist goes on a motorbike. And we just saw that in your film, the protagonist was riding also a scooter. And there is this a love story, so we think you would be perfect for it. Do you want to do it? So I read the script and I said, okay, sure, let's do it, you know. My Italian, it was sort of like not great, I have to say. I mean, I was, you know, I spoke Italian and Spanish. I'm from Spain and Italian is very similar to Spanish. It's not the same. So anyway, I was able to get through, you know, and then just start pre-production, you know, improve my Italian, get really good in my Italian. By the time I was done with the film. And what happened is that the film actually became a huge box office success in Italy. It did like, it was actually the most successful film for many years in terms of box office. So that was my second film. My first film, the one that I have done in Argentina, wasn't getting released because the production company actually went bankrupt before the film was released. So it just felt natural hanging out in Italy, enjoying the success of my second film. As a matter of fact, my first film, since the first film still hadn't come out. So, you know, in terms of release day. So that's what happened. So I stay in Italy, making films in Italian. Even though my first film was not a romantic comedy, now I was making films in Italy that they were romantic comedies. So that was great. It was good for a few years, for a few films. I actually made three projects there in Italy. And just when it was starting to get a little bit, not boring, I wouldn't say boring, but just when it started to get like too comfortable, you know, just doing the same thing and I wanted to do those things, I got a chance to direct the English remake of Nicholas Winding Refn, Pusher. So that was the project that brought me to London and allowed me to shoot my first film in English. The film worked out very well. It was released in the US theatrically and then VOD. It was in a few film festivals. It was in Toronto. It was in Edinburgh.
Wow.
So anyway, it got me the recognition to I would say get me back to the US, because that's where I went to film school in Los Angeles. So I went back basically to where I came from, in a way, you know, film studies in LA and all that. So then I was back in Los Angeles making films, and then one thing led to another. You know, I landed in Kidnap with Halle Berry, and that went very well, even though, again, you know, in this case, the distributor had also some financial troubles, and it took a couple of years to distribute the film, even though it was completed. But, you know, then it didn't matter. The film came out. It did very well and sort of like allowed me to keep making more films. So in a nutshell.
Yeah, no, that's great. Talk about how, like, after Pusher, what that was like. Like, you know, at that point, you must have managers and agents and everything from Italy. But did you have to get new representation in America? Like, how did that all play out, like, leading to getting the movie with Halle Berry?
Well, actually, I mean, after I did my film in Italy, since it was so successful, you know, I just went back to the States, because actually I was in the States before going to Europe to make films, thinking that I would be able to get an agent. But I didn't realize that my successful film, it was in Italian, and people didn't speak Italian in the US. So it didn't mean that much. So that was fine. You know, I just went back to Italy and kept making films in Italy. That's why when I got a chance to make a film in English, and that was Pusher, I knew that that was my calling card for making films in English. In this case, obviously, in the US. So having that, you know, done Pusher, it started, you know, already before even went to any film festivals, already, I guess, it was attracting enough attention that I got a call from an agency in Los Angeles that they wanted to represent me. And I say, sure, why not? Then everything just, you know, one thing followed the next thing. And, you know, before you realize, they bring you a script that you love and you say you want to do it. And you meet the producers. And in this case, Lorenzo Buenaventura, that is a fantastic producer. You know, he thought I was the right guy to direct the movie, and then got a chance to meet Halle, and she had seen my previous work. She saw my short film that I did before making my feature films, and she just loved my work, and we started working together, and that was how everything started. So yeah, one thing led to the other one, you know what I mean? And I will say this, because I mentioned at the beginning, before my feature film, my first feature film, what really launched my career was a short film that I made. It won many international prizes, I think like around 50 international prizes. And among them, it was the first Tribeca Film Festival. It won the best short film. So they say one piece brought together the next piece, and, you know, little by little, you build something like a career.
Wow. So how long did it take to get the Halle Berry movie after you got your agents? Was it just like a couple of years, or was it faster than that? Like, what was the process from like going from like your first English-speaking movie to your second English-speaking movie?
It didn't take that much. I want to think that maybe it was a year, maybe a year and a half. It was a film that came together really fast. I want to think that it took a year. You know, I read the script, I think, in February. Lorenzo Di Bonaventura told me that we're bringing the script to Cannes, because he was independently financed. And I think the second day, Halle Berry had been attached before going to Cannes. And I think the first or the second day of Cannes, the film was already financed. They were able to basically do international sales based on the elements of, you know, Halle Berry, obviously, that's the most important one, the script, the producers, also Lorenzo Bonaventura, and myself. And I think we were started shooting in September, so it really came together really fast, that project.
Wow. So have you ever been involved in, like, the fundraising for any of your films? Or has it been a situation where, like, from the circumstances, you've always just been hired to as a director for hire on all these projects?
Well, I work in many projects, in a way, or let me say it a different way. So I make feature films, I do also TV, but I also do more personal projects, like documentaries. I have done a couple of feature documentaries. And in the feature documentaries, I produce them myself, you know. So in that case, I've been involved in finding the money for those projects. Sometimes they are commissioned, so it's even better. You don't have to look for the money. They sort of like, someone calls you, hey, I got the money. You want to make the film? In my feature films, I was not involved in raising the money. They were, you know, both of them, the producers were the ones who raised the money. I mean, the producers in the case of Shutter and, you know, for Kidnap, it was Lorenzo Buenaventura and his production company, Di Bonaventura Pictures.
And then, like, Is this all you've had to do, like, since you made your first film in Spain? Like, have you had to do anything else to pay the bills, or have you been lucky enough to, like, just make films and that is provided for your whole life?
Well, for the whole life until now.
Right. No, you can't retire yet. Yeah, I get it.
Well, you know, yeah, I can't retire yet. I actually wouldn't want to retire. I love making movies. You know, I have been a lucky person in the sense that interesting enough, as I was saying before, so I went to film school. After film school, got different jobs, and then when I say, okay, enough, I wanna make a film. That's what I went to film school because I wanted to make films. So I did my short film, and I was lucky enough that it won so many prizes. And some of the prizes, they were cash prizes, that I lived very comfortably for 2 years. No, keep in mind that I was a student. So students live very comfortably with very little money. But it was fine. You know, I was extremely happy with it. But what I want to say is, like, it's not like I won millions. You know, I there would be prizes like, enough, you know, 10,000, 20,000, whatever. But there were so many that at the end it became almost like a paycheck. And then I was so lucky. In addition to all the economic prizes, I also got the recognition to make a feature film, write my first feature film. So I got paid for being a writer in the film, and then I got paid for being a director. And if it wasn't, you know, of course, your first film is not like you make a lot of money, but you make enough to live out of what you're doing. And then I have to say, after my Italian film that did very well in the box office, that gave me some, you know, some space to sort of like relax and be able to keep being a filmmaker, even if I was just making a film a year or every 2 years. And I have been lucky enough of not having to say yes to everything and just say, yes, I want to make this film because I really believe in the film. So, but yet I still live out of my films, you know, live as a filmmaker. So, you know, I'm a normal person, you know, that just, you know, is very passionate about his work and, you know, it's very selected, but yet at the same time, you know, I can do what I like, that is making films. So no side jobs.
After Pusher, I see that you did a lot of TV directing, as you mentioned. So how did that come about? Was that something that, like, you sought after, that you're like, oh no, I want to move into TV? Or was it more that, like, your new representation was like, oh, I can get you a job here. Like, it'll be lucrative. Like, you can just, you know, this is a good thing for you to do for your career.
Well, it's very interesting because it kind of started all in a very, like, an accent, in the sense that I go to the States, you know, very rapidly, I got kidnapped running. I knew I was going to do kidnap, I think, in March or early April. That was going to happen after the summer. And I felt like I needed to shoot something for making a film with Halle Berry and Lorenzo Bonaventura. In the sense that I have worked in Europe, in Argentina, in the UK, but not in the US. And I was not nervous, but I wanted to make sure that I knew how to make a film. Not how to make a film, I knew how to make a film. I wanted to make sure that I knew how was the workplace in the US. I didn't want it to have any surprises. So I worked very hard to try to get a TV job, whatever it was. I don't really hadn't done any TV in the US before. It's not like I could choose. So basically, I was able to find a very small project that, interesting enough, ended up being a cult series that it was C Nation with zombies. I have to say, my agents told me, Luis, don't do it. Do not do it. There is nothing there for you to learn. There is nothing there in this project. There is no money. There is nothing. It's a very small TV show. I said, you know, it doesn't matter. I'm not doing it for the project. I just want to see how it's a set, how it runs in the US. To my surprise, it was pretty much the same that in Europe, but in English. So they gave me the confidence of not having to worry about that element. Like, okay, I'm working in the US in English. And then, funny enough, the TV show became cult. And I think they have done like 7 or 8 seasons. So that was also interesting that this little TV show that I was doing became so big. I mean, I think I did like maybe episode 3 and 4 or 2 and 3, something like that. So yeah, it was pretty interesting to get there.
And did that allow you to make other TV shows? Because I see you went on to direct more shows after that. Was that like kind of the gateway to like open that world for you?
Well, in a way, yes. Because then what I realized, it became very obvious, is that the TV was becoming a very interesting place to be. There were great projects out there, great scripts. And what TV has is that it's sort of like something very rapid that it happens, you know. You you say, okay, I'm interested in working on TV. And then, you know, some I say, well, what about this? You know, because they know that you're interested and they send you a script and you read it. And it's, if you say yes, you know you're going to be doing this in the next 3 months. It's like, it happens. It's something very fast. Where working in films, it's sort of like the opposite. You say you want to make a film, but it takes a long time to get to actually film the, to make the film. You know, it's a much slower process, you know. So there is something very interesting about doing TV. It's, you know, it allows you to keep, you know, making films. You know, it's more than just going to the gym and doing exercise. It's actually like, hey, you're making films. And there are great projects out there, and I have been very lucky to work in some great series. And when I can, I make films, and when I can, I make TV shows. You know, like, I don't really make a difference between one and the other. And I think actually lately, you know, also because of the pandemic, we all ended up watching a lot of films or TV shows at home. It doesn't really make that big difference to me, 1 million or the other one. Almost, I would say sometimes a TV show becomes almost like a Russian film from the 80s that is 3 hours long or 4 hours long, because that's what people do. They sit down at home and watch 3 episodes or 4 episodes. That's like 2 hours, 3 hours. You're like, well, there you go. We went back to Russian films, you know, 10-hour films, basically. That's what the TV shows are sometimes.
Right. When you work on a TV show versus a...
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Movie, does your process as a director change, or is it kind of the same, but just in a different medium?
Well, it's very different in a way, because when you're doing the film, you start from the very beginning and you carry the whole process to the very end. You are the vision. You are the conductor of the orchestra. Everything is on your shoulders. Of course, you have the producers. You have many, many key heads of department that are working with you, but you sort of have like the big vision of everything. When you're working on a TV show, that sometimes it is true if you're doing the pilot, but even then, the role of the showrunner is more important than the role of the director, in the sense that it is the showrunner's vision. It's no longer the director's vision. The director is someone who works for the showrunner. It's sort of like making it happen, what the showrunner wrote and wants in the show. So it's a very different approach in a way. It's also a very interesting approach, I have to say. I think it's equally exciting, you know, works for someone's visions than for your own vision. You know, you get to learn a lot and discover things that you didn't imagine. So it's also a form of growing, you know, just collaborating, you know, making films, making TV shows. It's all about collaborating and working with teams. So if you have a great team, it's fantastic because you're learning from everyone.
How do you manage coming into a TV show that's already been running for a little while and that, like, you have to come in and sort of execute the vision of the showrunner, as you said? Do you do a lot of prep work, or like, do you like try to make sure that you're following the same style and aesthetic, or do you try to bring in some of your own style and aesthetic to your episode to kind of like make it, you know, feel like its own thing within the whole show?
Well, I had both experiences. I had the experience of making some TV shows where they have been running. I did an episode of the second season of Code Black. So that was a machine that was already running. It's a very clear vision of what the show was about. So literally you come in and you just fulfill a role, the role of the director. And, you know, it's very clear what you have to do. Everything is, you know, there is a Bible that you can read and, like, you know, this is how it gets done. And again, it's very interesting because you do things that you usually wouldn't do because maybe, you know, it's not your intuition to go in that direction. But I have to say, most of the TV work that I have done, it has been in shows that they were first season, and it has been always either the first episodes, like I just did was recently a show in Mexico, All the Blood, that was, I did the first 5 episodes, so you have to literally build the whole look of the project from scratch. Or there have been like early episodes, and the way when sometimes TV shows are shot, like I did White Lines, and I was literally shooting at the same time that the director who was shooting the first 2 episodes. So you find yourself that you have to interpreting things that they haven't happened yet. You know, what is going to be the look of the show? Well, there is no reference. There is no visual reference. There is written reference. There are conversations. There are images that we have in our minds. But it's not like you can really say, well, okay, I see, I know what it looks like, you know. So you have to interpret it, something that is being getting cooked as you are cooking. This is, you know, you have two kitchens cooking at the same time and you are both serving the same meal, but you don't really know what it's going to be until, you know, the plates are done in a way. So that's very interesting because it allows you a lot of conversations with the showrunners, you know, trying to get everyone's visions and interpretate it and just go for it and do your best. And I think the key is always working close to the showrunners. So you make sure that what you're doing is what they want. So you feel more, you know, successful. That's the key secret, you know, just working always very close to the showrunner. So it's very exciting because at the end of the day, you have to interpret it something that is written and being for seasons, you know, it hasn't been done before. The show itself is trying to figure out what it's about, what is the language of the show. So it's something organic. So it's just, it's a very exciting project, I have to say, when you're working for seasons.
So I want to talk a little bit about your process as a director working with actors. And so the question is, like, how do you like to work with actors? And then part two to the question is, does it change when you work with somebody like John Malkovich or Halle Berry, who's like, you know, been doing it for so long and is such a big star? Like, do you have to shift or do you come in with the same approach every time?
No, I think that the most important thing is to remember, to know that every actor is a human being and every actor is completely different to every other actor, as every human being is very different from every other human being. So at the end of the day, I think the job of the director is to understand what you need to give to each actor, what is what they need. And most of this tends to happen when you're preparing the film. So in the case of Halle Berry or John Malkovich or Frank Grillo, you talk about what the character is about. And what can I say? I mean, Halle Berry is an Oscar winning actor. She is fantastic. So getting to direct her is amazing because it's allowing you to also tell her, Halle, I think we should go more in this direction or in this other direction. It's even shocking when you have an actor of the calibers of Malkovich, Halle, or Frank that come and ask you, so am I supposed to go this way or this other way? So it's very interesting, you know, and you know, and obviously your job is to keep in mind the whole picture. And that's sometimes what you need to bring to even the most prepared actor, and is to maybe say, hey, by the way, we're coming from here, we're going over there, just in case, you know, you forgot. No, afterwards, they blow your mind because you are expecting something and they're so amazing that they just keep growing, and they just bring you something that you couldn't imagine as a director. And again, with other actors and in Shutter, you know, we have Cameron Monaghan, Lily Crook, very young actor, both of them, they're amazing. And pretty much something similar happens. You know, you prepare the film a little bit more with them. So, you know, they're the two protagonists of the film, so there is more to prepare, more to rehearse, to talk about the character, where they're coming from, where they're going, what the film is about. And then sometimes it's just a question of, you know, just giving little touches as you're directing, because, you know, it's a machine that is working along, you know what I mean? I think it was Woody Allen who told to an actor that after several, I think after having shot half of the film, the actor went to Woody Allen and asked him, listen, it's half of the film that we have shot and you haven't told me anything yet. Am I doing anything wrong? And the story goes that Woody Allen told him, well, you're doing everything right. Otherwise, I would have fired you already. That's where I got you. So there is a little bit of that in the sense that when you have great actors, you know, sometimes you just have to walk with them and enjoy the ride, you know, and obviously work as a team. But, you know, sometimes I don't want to say there is very little to do. You just do that before shooting, you know, that's what you did.
How much prep time do you get with these actors before going into the project? Like, do you get like a couple of rehearsal days or like, is it just a couple of Zoom meetings? Like, what is the prep that you get when working with actors like this?
It really depends. And I have to say this film was shot during COVID. So that implied that, you know, many of the readings we did then on Zoom, on online, so we wouldn't, you know, so we keep social distancing. We shot it in the spring. So there were still a lot of unknowns about levels of safety, what was safe, what was not. So as much as possible, we tried to do everything remotely. Then eventually we did a thing with Cameron and Lily that are the two protagonists, main protagonists. We did, I want to think, like a week of rehearsals. Oh. So we went through every single scene and go through the blocking. Obviously, we didn't have the house to rehearse physically in the space, but I tried to explain then, okay, this is what it's going to look like. This is what the location looks like. You know, expect this, let's expect that. And then with other actors like Grillo, Frank Grillo is an actor that is very busy. So he literally came in like 2-3 days before filming. So basically you just sit down, have a meal with them or have a coffee, have a drink, wherever is available. Just sort of go through the character and, you know, and make sure that we're both in the same page, you know, that we both understand what we're doing. So then when you're filming, you are on the run, you know, so you don't have to talk about, oh, wait, I thought I was this, why was that? You know, so it's kind of like clear, you know. And again, you know, we're talking of, you know, amazing actors that they, you know, they bring such an amazing background and work to the film that, you know, you really want to just sit down and listen and just, you know, see what happened, you know what I mean? Obviously, you know, you prepare the character with them and all that, but I find it very fascinating and exciting, you know, working with actors. And obviously, you know, when you have actors like John Malkovich, you feel like, oh, wow, amazing. I get to direct John Malkovich. That was something, that was one of my dreams. And Frank Grillo, well, here the same, you know, they're great, you know, and as human beings, and they're fantastic actors. So it's really like, you know, just great. Making movies is like the best thing you could do.
I wanted to ask about your process in saying yes to a project, because you said before that's like you read the script, you fall in love. Like, what is it about a script that will get you to say yes and, you know, decide that you're going to devote like 2-3 years, 4 years to a project?
Well, I'm a big movie goer. I think my interest in films came from watching a lot of films. It happened to be that as I was growing up, I would go to the Cinematheque and watch 2-3 films a week, where it felt a lot. It felt a lot when I was 12. That's when I really started watching films. So basically, when I read the script, the first thing that I think is, am I going to enjoy watching this film? Is this a good film to watch? I read it as if I was the spectator. So if I think I'm going to find myself entertaining the movie, that's the first step to say, okay, I want to make it. The more excited about I am about watching a movie, the more interested I am in making the movie. And then there are other elements that are very important when you decide to make a movie, well, at least in my case. In Shutter, it was actually, there were a combination of two things. The script presented some limitations, and those limitations felt just right in a year of a pandemic. So shooting under COVID, it was obviously an element that it was gravitating in my head. So finding a script with very few characters that is very much contained, that is a thriller, really exciting. It was like, okay, I think this is a great project that I know I can deliver even under a pandemic, where we won't have to stop shooting because following the industry protocols, the risk will be minimum because we really have very few actors and very few locations. Now, that doesn't mean that the film is poor. It just is very smart. It was, the film is written in a very smart way. So with very few elements, it's capable of doing a lot. It would be like, you know, thinking of chess, well, it's just blacks and whites, you know, but yet, you know, or checkers, you know, you can play many, many games and never get bored with it. So it was a little bit like that, you know, very few elements, but yet very, very intense and emotional thriller.
So I think with that, we have to go to our final 6 questions. I'll try to get through these pretty quick, and we only have 6 minutes. What's the first film you made, and how do you feel about it now? And it can be first feature, for a short film, however you want to answer the question.
Well, my first short, it was my first film, because I really wanted to make also a showcase of what I could do. And it was a short film where I had a love story, a musical, an action film, and a thriller all together in 12 minutes. You know, I had all these elements in 12 minutes. So I was actually trying to make a short reel in a way, but yet I also wrote a story that it was powerful enough, as it proved to be with time, that it incorporated all those elements, and it was very exciting to make and to realize, wow, you can have all those things in a film. And in a way, that also happened in Shutter. It's a great thriller, but it has also a fantastic love story. It has a lot of humor, quirkiness, and you work in a film in many, many layers, so it doesn't get bored. You know, you don't get bored watching the film. You sort of like enjoy it. All the elements, because some of them definitely you don't expect it in that film, you know.
And then what's the best filmmaking advice you've ever received?
Well, I guess the best filmmaking advice, you know, this is, I would say this is the best advice for the first-time filmmakers. I think that it only applies to first-time filmmakers. So this is very important because I would say after being a first-time filmmaker, this advice probably would be the worst advice you can get. But for first-time filmmakers, the best advice is just follow your guts and don't listen to anyone. So make sure, you know, in your first film, everyone got a lot of opinions. Most people got, probably everyone has much more experience than you. So you could listen to everyone and make everyone's film, or you could just ignore everyone and make your film. And that would be my advice to first-time filmmakers. Listen to your guts. That doesn't apply for first-time filmmakers because probably you want to see what everyone else has to say too.
And then what's the worst filmmaking advice that you've ever received?
Probably the worst advice, you know, I guess it was in the form of a critique, and it's sort of like bears reference to the first one. When I finished my short film, I showed it to a group of five people, and they were all filmmakers, young filmmakers like me that were trying to break in the film world. And I got killed. They literally killed my short. They said that it was didn't make any sense. You know, they just didn't get it. So I would say that was the worst advice you can get, is like, let other ones judge your work, in the sense that if you think it's good, okay, it's good. You're right. You know, if you really believe in something, you know, you just keep going until the end. So I'm very glad, for example, that I didn't listen to any of those five people and send my film to all those festivals, like the Tribeca Film Festival, because it became the winner of the Tribeca Film Festival. So anyway, I guess that's the advice. Don't listen to anyone in your first films.
And then, do you have a goal as a filmmaker?
Well, I guess my goal is to keep making films. You know, it feels like, you know, there are incredible careers of filmmakers that they are just keep building and making wonderful film after wonderful film. And that is really exciting. So I hope that's my goal, to be able to keep making films and hopefully have a very long career.
If you could go back in time, what's one piece of advice that you would give yourself?
I think I gave only good pieces of advice to myself. No, I think that I'm very happy how I landed where I landed. You know, I think that I was quick enough to give those advices to myself. So I think at some point in my life, I said like, okay, what is what I want to do? I want to do this. All right. So I just need to focus. I need to drop everything else and just focus. And that's what I did. And, you know, I guess I took my own advice. So that was pretty good.
And final question, is making movies hard?
Yes and not, in the sense that, you know, I think there are jobs that are much more harder than making movies. So in that sense, it's not. I think we're playing. We're just having fun. Having said that, also having fun making movies can be hard for many reasons. Sometimes because, you know, I would say for the actors, you know, they're playing with summer clothes, you know, winter day, like in the scene of Shadow Rock, we have Cameron Monaghan and Frank Grillo driving a yellow convertible in Montana. Well, that day was snowing, but little that I know, it was too late to change that car or to put the roof, because we had shot the previous scene where we saw the car with the roof down. So we have to shoot it with the roof down in a snowy day. So was it hard for Frank Grillo and Cameron Monaghan? Yes, it was freezing cold. Everyone had gloves, hats. They had the kind of like light clothes. So in that sense, it was very hard for them. But again, everything is relative. You put that with what other people are doing, that's not hard. You know, that's, you know, other people are doing much harder jobs out there. So no, I think we're lucky people. That's what makes movies.
Awesome. And then last question, where can people watch Shattered? Where can people find it? And where can people find out more about you as a filmmaker?
Well, okay. So Shattered is coming. It will be available in select theaters and on demand on January 14th. So that is in literally a little bit more than 2 weeks. And then it will be available in Blu-ray and DVD on February 22nd. So if you can go to the movie theaters, if you feel like going to the movie theaters, January 14th. And if not, video on demand, January 14th.
All right, it is time for the game. For those of you who don't know, this is a game that was invented by our producer, Eric Toms, where we are tasked with a filmmaking quandary, an indie filmmaking scenario that we must vanquish and come up with a solution to. We don't get access to these in advance, so I'm going to read this one today for Liz, and she has not heard this before. This is going to be brand new to her. And I actually haven't even fully read it yet either. So it's going to kind of be brand new to me too. So Liz will answer first, and then I'll give my input after. And here we go. You're 20 days into a 25-day shoot for a monster film. Your monster has a very complicated latex face and bodysuit that must be applied by a very skilled makeup artist. The climax of the film is being shot in an exotic location, but the producers have told you that the above-the-line cast and crew will be the only ones traveling. The production will hire a new makeup artist when they get there. When you arrive on set, you discover that the new makeup artist is not up to the task and the effects do not match. Do you A, keep the monster in the dark to hide the mistakes? B, try and reshoot everything with the monster's new look in this new location and hope it matches the original shots? Rewrite the ending so it features the monster far less and hope that the story still makes sense and has a proper climax. Other, what do you do, director? What do you do?
I mean, it depends on how far away this quote-unquote exotic location is and how much I trust my original makeup artist. Because what I probably would do is figure out just how to get the original hire to the location that we're at. And I don't know if we'd be sacrificing days or budget, or if I could take some of my fee. If it's a monster film, I assume it's a little bit bigger of a budget than ever I've dealt with as a micro budget indie filmmaker. I could be wrong, but my goal would be to do whatever I can to get the original artist with me back on set at that new location and travel them and take care of them. That to me provides the most amount of continuity for the artistry in the film. I have someone that I trust. I have collaboration. And it's weird to me to think that we would go with a crew member that I hadn't talked to. And at the very least, that the other makeup artist didn't talk to. Like, there should be continuity between the two different artists. And I don't like that. In this hypothetical scenario, I wasn't good about creating that continuity. So I would work on just getting that original makeup artist there and continue with the plan as written with the right craftsperson. Ulrich, what would you do?
Well, I'm going to challenge you a little bit. Like, let's say that you can't get the makeup artist back, that this is impossible, that like, and you're stuck with this new makeup artist and you have to solve the problem. What would you do in that scenario?
The thing is, we fired a makeup artist on Speed of Life because they have their attitude. And we found someone, you know, within a few hours and replaced them. And maybe this exotic locale doesn't have a giant cross-section of a makeup artist there. So I understand what you're saying. But I feel like when I worked on Speed of Life and when I did Witchy, I had a VFX artist who basically was like, you have no idea how much I can fix with visual effects. And so I would probably be trying to create some sort of replication of the original art that I approved of with the craftsperson that I liked using VFX. So maybe it's just reducing the amount of special effects makeup in its practical form and then unfortunately punting it for post.
Nice. I love that additional answer. Okay. So having worked on a movie where something like this kind of happened, or maybe not, I guess that's not fair because I don't really know the details, but basically a situation where the footage came back and no one was happy with it. Basically, I think here's a couple things. First, I'm going to assume a couple things. First, I'm going to assume that A, the original makeup artist worked with this new makeup artist remotely and like passed on all their notes.
That's what I'm saying. I don't think they did. I think there's no continuity between these two people.
I'm just saying that
make the assumption.
Because I know that you can, that this could happen and that like you could do everything right and that it would still go terribly wrong because makeup is really, really tricky. And like, you wouldn't even know like if the original person would have done a better job in that scenario because of the things that are happening from shipping the stuff or, you know, like in this new location, maybe it's a little hotter and like the glue is melting. Like, who knows, right? All kinds of
fair
problems.
Point. Yeah.
But I basically look at this kind of the way that you did, like where, you know, I'm also going to assume that the monster hasn't really been seen very much yet at this point. So it's like kind of been hidden in the movie beforehand. So this is the big moment for it to shine. So I feel like the continuity is probably less of an issue, but like more of the bigger issue would be like making sure this thing looks as cool as it's supposed to look.
Yeah.
So I would probably roll with like, what do we got here? Like, what can we do to make this thing look
as cool as possible. And that is going to like connect to what we've already shot and lean into that. So if that means rewriting the movie to like make this monster more badass, I would do that because I think that would work really well. And then whatever it, like we can't do on set, then we would do with visual effects, you know, and like shoot it in a way where you're thinking of that, where you're like, okay, well, I know that this doesn't look the way that I want it for this reason. Like, here's what we're going to do in post to make it look X way. So I would kind of do a combination of all the answers, like rewriting, like shooting it in a new way to embrace what we have. And then also, you know, setting yourself up for success with some plans for visual effects. And my baby is wiggling like crazy.
So funny. Right, this is a wiggly baby.
He will not be contained. He wants to move it. He wants to eat my burrito. He is very excited to be here right now.
This is what we used to call Colin. We called him a squirmy wormy. That's what I'm seeing in front of me, is a very squirmy wormy.
Anyways, babies aside, what do you guys think? What would you do? Have you been in a situation like this before? Like, what was your solution? Send us your responses, your questions, your comments, your suggestions to podcast@makingmoviesishard.com. Or if you really like the show, you can leave us a review on iTunes, which would be super awesome. You can also check us out on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter @MMIH Podcast and YouTube @Making Movies Is Hard Podcast. Thanks to our editor, Jeff Reimert, for doing the editing. Thanks to Robert Jones for doing all of our social media. And thanks to our producer, Eric Toms, for simply being awesome. Thanks to you all for listening, and we'll talk to y'all next week.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
You know when you're listening to a true crime story that has an unbelievable plot twist that makes you stop in your tracks? That's what our podcast, People Are the Worst, brings you with each episode. I'm Rachel.
And I'm Rebecca. We're identical twins who love true crime cases that make you say, "Didn't see that coming," and we hate the people responsible for them. Listen to People Are the Worst now on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.